So, Jacob, quick question. What is a witch?
I mean, I don't know what a witch is particularly.
See, this interests me. So, if you don't know what a witch is, how do you know that you yourself are not one?
I'm literally over here shaking, crying, throwing up. I have no way of knowing.
I mean, you
I
know.
probably am, come
How
to
do you
think
think
of
I
it.
feel? I'm probably a witch. We this could be the first and only podcast that is Witches for Socialism.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is, one could pose the same question. I quite often, from critics, I'm accused of being woke, and I would ask them, "What does woke mean?" They never can define it, and then you have to ask them, "How do you know you, in fact, are not woke, sir?" Ben Shapiro proceeds to collapse into a puddle of tears. Cannot stand the fact that he may, in fact, be woke.
Reactionary levels drop to 0%.
Exactly. Owned.
Listening to Socialist Shelf Radio.
Well, welcome to the Socialist Shelf, the podcast that likes to own Ben Shapiro, investigate witches, not so we can burn them, not so that we can hang them, not so that we can crush them with rocks, so we can give them, a good talking to, win them over to our side, because, all the powers of sorceress might will be useful in the struggles to come, I would think.
Yeah, they witches have hexed the moon. We could certainly use them against the capitalists.
I think it would be useful. I think it would be useful. And I mean, according to witches, according to this text, if you believe everything that someone accuses a witch of being able to do, they actually don't have that many impressive powers. Like, it's stuff that I could do. Like, oh, you killed a newborn baby. Okay, I could do that. You stabbed a woman with a needle. Okay, I could do that. You made someone slightly choke. Like, okay, you made someone uncomfortable.
They
You
have
made
the
it, you
power. They
know.
have the power to, copy your movements and your speech. And okay, my little sister was doing that when she was 3 years old. That's not impressive.
Not all that impressive. It can make a teenage girl be dramatic. Well, all teenagers are dramatic. That's not anything to make a 16-year-old freak out. The
Is
slightest
Taylor Swift, in
provocation.
fact, a witch?
I mean, like that. There. Wait. Did you see that Twitter thread? No joke.
No.
This guy. There's this like crazy alt-right guy who had a conspiracy theory that Taylor Swift's been alive since the 70s. Or like that, like there's like she was an adult in the 70s, to be clear, and it's like a Satanist that went by another name and has been eating blood. And then there's like on Christian TikTok, there's this guy who was like, no, if you go to the Satan parties, it's like QAnon slash Christian TikTok. It's like one of those crossovers.
Oh
He's
my
like,
God.
I saw a video, I saw it say Taylor Swift was eating human blood and like dancing seductively and stuff. And it's like, as someone who would like, is a fan of Taylor Swift, to my own shame, I understand. She's not nearly that interesting. She's
Hey,
not nearly
there's no such thing as a guilty pleasure, Jacob.
there. Well, there. She's not nearly interesting enough to partake in satanic rituals. The only satanic rituals she's partaking in are the burning of fossil fuels at unbelievable scales. But we'll leave that for another day. But if you have not figured it out yet, we are talking about Arthur Miller's The Crucible. That's right, folks. We can do theater because you know why theater gets written down? We can read it. It's not against the rules. Send the police to arrest us. We'll just evade them.
Hey, being a cruciboy is not a crime, right?
That's
Crucing it
true.
up.
A crucible is for silver and a smelter for gold, but the Lord is a tester of hearts, from Proverbs 17:3. And many could say that the socialist shelf is also a tester of hearts. And in this case, I was interested in this. I'll be perfectly honest. The crucible had been in my head, but also like, when I was thinking of like, what should we talk about? It was on my shelf. And I was like, shoot, I kind of had that in mind. I also have a personal attachment to the Crucible as it was a play I was in high school. And it was probably in theater. Like I was into theater in high school, never had an amazing singing voice. I could kind of hit the notes if I worked really hard on it for a while ahead of time, but I was in the Crucible, which required zero singing, which I really appreciated. I played Judge Danforth because I was loud and large and looming and could scare everyone. But I was reading along in this book and it immediately, the lines were coming back to me. Not everything, but the courtroom scene, I immediately was like, I don't even have to read this. I know it. I did, but it was like, it immediately started flowing. Now, you I will say my school changed the language of some things to make it more acceptable. We were not allowed to say whore. We had to say Jezebel and such. But
believable.
Jezebel is fine though. Like there's worse. They didn't make us say like floozy or something, you know, like they let us say an archaic word. Like you could say Jezebel and it has the same power to it, you know, I think.
Just a couple of floozies for socialism.
Just a couple of floozies for socialism is that'll be our sister pod.
Yes. Yes. I had not read the whole play cover to cover until a couple of days ago. Mm. Now I've been in theater classes where we did scenes from the Crucible. You know, of course I saw the fantastic Daniel Day-Lewis Winona Ryder film in high school.
I didn't know till today that Daniel Day-Lewis was Arthur Miller's son-in-law. That killed me.
No shit.
Yeah. Yeah. Married his daughter.
Hmm. Wow. Today I learned.
Mm-hmm. So did I today to Daniel Day, if you think about it, many are saying this. But anyway, what were you saying, Joss?
But yes, no. So I had not read the Crucible cover to cover until now. It's, you know, it's funny. Like this is so stupid. Judge Danforth keeps calling John Proctor Mister, right?
Yeah.
Which, you know, that was normal language for the day or whatever. But, like, I just kept in my head, I was reading his lines like a sassy gay voice, like, you better confess, mister.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he kind of has. He, you know, that's a interesting thing about theater, and we'll get into it, is it's like, you can read it in different ways, right? You could absolutely have a sassy gay Danforth. You could have a Danforth who does not believe in any of this. He's completely cynical. The way I played Danforth when I was in the Crucible, and look, I'm not sure if I was good or not. I like, we did well at like regionals, but to be clear, this was like a high school theater regionals, one act regionals. Yes, we condensed the Crucible down to one act. It's actually not very difficult to do because like you have an hour to do it. This play is not very long. You can do this play in an hour if you just cut out a little bit, like some dialogue here and there. At least we did. We were very successful in it. People said I was good, but what I tried to do, and you know, I fear to look back at those old videos because I like to think I did well. But I remember playing it like, no, this Danforth is a complete believer, which is how I read it. Danforth is a believer because if he stops believing, then his power that he has been entrusted by the state no longer has legitimacy because the state and the God are one to him, which was a very Marxist reading of me from me at like 15 years old without having not really read Marx. So, you know, props to young Jacob for that one.
Yeah. And by the events of the day, you know, a relatively indifferent state, a relative, mm-hmm. you know, interested in the proceedings, certainly, but not necessarily intervening directly, you know, a relatively indifferent God, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, God is dead, according to John Proctor.
John Nietzsche Proctor.
Yeah. We'll get into it, though. Yeah. So we want to, I want to talk about Arthur Miller, the guy himself, of course. And we want to talk about the Salem witch trials as well. You know, the Salem witch trials are, of course, going to be a phenomenon that's probably recognized by our listeners. But Joss, do you want to give like the brief overview and then I can get into Miller?
Yeah, absolutely. So most of my information here I draw from the Smithsonian article on the Salem trials. It's a pretty good overview. I dip a little into Peter Leeson and Jacob Russ's article, Witch Trials, in the Oxford Economic Journal, on the broader European phenomenon that gave rise to this. So, of course, listeners, as y'all are doubtless aware, Salem, Massachusetts saw a series of trials in 1692 in which over 200 people were accused of witchcraft. 30 were found guilty, 14 women and 5 men were hanged. One man, notorious Giga Chad Giles Corey, was pressed to death by heavy stones. We'll
not as big as the stones that were on him, but you know.
I mean, there's always a bigger stone.
Yeah, exactly. No, not bigger than Giles's, but you know. Mm-mm.
At least 5 people died in prison. 2 dogs were also executed, notably for
R.I.P. to the real ones. Yeah.
Yeah. So this comes on the tail end of a phenomenon that had swept Europe from about the early 1400s to the late 1700s. 100,000 people, mostly women, were accused of witchcraft, roughly half of them executed for it. The estimates go up and down depending on who you speak to. This is neither here nor there, but about 60% of those prosecutions came between 1560 and 1630, which is a period known as the Great Hunt. Mm. And more than half of those were within a 300-mile radius of Strasbourg, France. So that's most of southern Germany. Spain, Italy, Portugal mostly avoided witch trials. There were not many on Ireland. There were tons in Scotland because, in part, James VI was terrified of witches. Right. So Leeson and Russ identified this European phase of the phenomenon as, this was interesting to me, religious market share contestation. Mm. So, like, confessionally contested, like, Catholic and Protestant parts of Europe, like Northeast France, Southern Germany, saw particularly violent witch hunts, right? Because Catholic authorities and various Protestant churches that sprang up, because there were many, wanted to consolidate their temporal authority. And one way to do that was to prove their ability to safeguard people against demonic influences. Leeson and Russ actually compare it directly to Democrats and Republicans fighting over battleground states, which I find which I find pretty funny.
Joss, it's almost like you're saying superstructure arises from the base, from the economic conditions in which it's created. That's I would never have imagined.
Somebody should write something about that.
Yeah, maybe. Hmm.
But well, there were a whole host of reasons that would lead people to marry superstition with material ambition, right? Now, in Salem, of course, you do have that element, right? In the Crucible, as historically, you have Reverend Paris, Salem village's first ordained minister. He's seeking to burnish his reputation against accusations of greed. You know, he has the pressure of being the first guy. On top of this, however, you have a whole lot going on. You have a war between England and France pushing refugees into the coastal New England. That puts a strain on the resources there. You have class tensions between this incipient bourgeois class involved in trade, Salem's a major port at this time, between them and those who derive their wealth from land and farming, which is a split that anticipates much of what divided the ruling class of the early United States through the Civil War. Scaling down to the more personal, right, you have medical ailments of an unknown nature causing miscarriages, sudden infant death, you know, personal sorrow of all types. You even, and this is Arthur Miller's artistic liberty, you even have adultery and misguided infatuation, which draws people into this hysteria in ways that they cannot necessarily predict or control.
And I will note also the misplaced anxiety of the settler, right? Because they're there among this woods that they see as this heathen wood, and they're there, and notably, and we'll get into it, like, who is among the first accused? Tituba, a slave brought from Barbados.
Yes.
It is. So it's a lot of this, like, the anxiety and the paranoia of the settler, of the white colonial settler, in this unfamiliar to them land, even though they've maybe even been there a few generations, some of these people having come over, like Paris, some of these people having been born here, nevertheless feeling like they're, you know, at odds, that alienation that arises from that. It is the perfect storm to create something like this.
Yes, exactly. A perfect storm with one added ingredient, which is superstition, right?
Yes.
Like, as I was piecing this together, I remembered what my Shakespeare professor talked about in our classes, the average person's faith in the supernatural around this time. Like, specifically, he was discussing in the early modern English context, but this applied all over Europe and later to its colonial frontiers, right? The faith that there were demons and angels and fairies and forces beyond our perception working to influence the material plane, the faith that that was the case was as rock solid as our faith that if you step off a 10-story building, you'll fall and die, right?
Right.
And if you denied demons, you also denied Almighty God fighting demons, right? Mm-hmm. And so undergirding all these tensions that we speak of is this precedent for belief in the immaterial, right? You know, Arthur Miller in the narration during the text alludes to this, right? The dematerialization of social divides, such as those we've touched on above, right? Dematerialization tactically for gain strategically, right, is what this play is really all about. You know, suddenly you see old grudges over land and resources hashed out on this grand battlefield of good versus evil, the sacred versus the profane, the crewmates versus the imposters, right?
Yeah, all of that.
Yeah, it's not your farming rights at stake suddenly. It's your very soul, right? The person who's logging on your land is not doing it because, you know, it's your word against his where the boundary is, right? It's because he's, you know, being possessed by Satan or whatever, right? It's you, not your farming rights at stake. It's your very soul. And even the most virtuous among us may, in fact, be sus.
Indeed. And it's worth, and it's not surprising that this play gets written in 1953.
Oh, yeah.
Which we will get into. So Arthur Miller, our writer, we have, this is an interesting guy.
Miller?
And also, yeah.
I barely know her.
I was going to say, you want to do the honors, Miller? I barely know. There you go. As all stories do, it starts in 1915 in New York. He was born to a Polish Jewish family of immigrants who owned a clothing store and then, as many did, lost it all in 1929. A lot of that was going around. So, yeah, this is a guy who came from, you know, they were fairly well off. They had a maid and stuff, not rich, but then they lost everything. So he basically had to work odd jobs to get through high school and then get through college. So he was a guy who, you know, while he had tasted some money and while he definitely had these like more higher level intelligentsia pretensions, definitely had to work, Miller did. He goes to the University of Michigan, and the University of Michigan still to this day loves this guy, and he loved the University of Michigan. The only theater in the world named after Arthur Miller by his express desire is at the University of Michigan. The University of Michigan's highest award in English in theater is named after Arthur Miller. Arthur Miller donated large sums to the university through his life. He loves this. He loved this place, and this place really does still love him. While he was there, he majored in journalism, and then decided, no, actually like theater, so he majored in English. He switched. Wrote the play No Villain, his first play ever, over his spring break because he just wanted to win a cash prize really bad. And then he found out, wait, I like doing this.
I assume there was no villain in the play.
I don't know. I haven't read it. And during this time, he's a copywriter. He's a psychiatric aide at one point. He kind of gives me the vibe of a guy who like lies on resumes a lot. Like you look at his job history, like how quickly he leaves places and like whatever. He seems like a guy who like can really kind of talk his way in a door. That's editorializing, but it does seem interesting that this like college student was working at all these different places that he by like no means was qualified to work, especially in a time when work was so like scarce. But again, yeah, editorializing. I mean,
get that bag, you know, especially at that time.
Absolutely. So he starts to have a little bit of success, not as a writer so much, but like as like a known academic. He does have some staff jobs at NYU and the University of New Hampshire, nothing very tenuous, kind of adjunct work. But he, you know, manages to scrape by basically. During this time, he gets very, very, especially as a Jewish man, concerned about the rise of fascism, both in the United States and abroad. And if you were an anti-fascist in the 1930s, there was one group who were more anti-fascist than anybody else, and that was the communists. They were the only consistent anti-fascists at the time. The U.S. state very much still placating the fascists, very much still courting Hitler and Mussolini and certainly Franco and people like that. He found the communists to be the people who were consistently against the fascists. Now, Miller did not consider himself a communist, and he never did. He's actually quite similar to Camus in that way. But in the same way as Camus, I would say he's a little bit more principled than Camus, but in the same way as Camus, he basically joins up with the communists because he's like, yeah, these are the guys who are fighting the fight that I fundamentally believe in. Mm-hmm. So he decides not to join the Communist Party, but he does join the League of American Writers in 1935, which is an openly communist, like it's openly a front for the Communist Party, for people like Miller who are like, I'm an artist, I'm a writer, I want to be an anti-fascist, I'm not quite ready to toe the party line. The party was like, cool, we'll bring you in. Sure. Notably, there are like, you know, there are notably like all kinds of great organizations like that through history or whatever. And it's also, I don't want to like say it like, oh, these are people that like couldn't cut it in the Communist Party. There were plenty of people in the Communist Party who were in this. You know, I honestly, it makes me think of things like Artists Against Apartheid and stuff like that today, like interesting organizations that are like tied to coalitions that are doing work and are able to express their own things, but also were able to work ideologically and stuff with other organizations.
Yeah,
it's interesting.
exactly. You know, you have the professional revolutionary, you know, and then you have the people adjacent to them, right? Who do different work, you know, that is no less valuable.
Oh yeah, no doubt. And quite a few people were in both organizations, and that's what made it critical.
Precisely.
So he in that organization runs basically through the end of World War II until it's like disbanded. Just because they felt that not their work was done, but their immediate task was complete, which was like that period of fighting fascism. He writes other plays in this time, and he works for a theater program that gets shut down because people get afraid it's full of communists. It is full of communists, so guilty as charged. He starts working for 20th Century Fox and freelance writing radio dramas, some of which are just lost to time. They're just radio dramas that got aired a few times and now they're just gone. He marries Mary Grace Slattery in 1940 and has two children, and wrote the play The Man Who Had All the Luck, which is about a modern day King Midas. And it fails horribly. He says, in fact, if I do this poorly on another play, I'll never write another word again. I'm going to find something else to do.
He wasn't the man who had all the luck.
He was not the man who had all the luck. And at this time, he also doesn't manage to get to go to World War II, which he's kind of interested in doing. But then he's got a bad football injury, his knee, relatable for me. Also have a bad knee injury from football. Yeah. And so he's not able to go overseas. So in 1947, he writes All My Sons, which does pretty well. And 1948, he writes what is his second most popular work, The Death of a Salesman. Both huge successes, especially Death of a Salesman, makes him really significant money and brings him quite a lot of acclaim. And notably, he gets a lot of work in Hollywood, starts writing screenplays, consulting. Writing just he's like a guest essayist at places. He's like seen as somebody at this point, a man about town, as it were. He could do guest lectures, wherever, whatever he wants to do. Around this time, he reads a book that really influences him. This book is called The Devil in Massachusetts, written in 1867, and it is a comprehensive history of the Salem witch trials. And he reads this in 49, and then just a couple years later, a friend of his, Elia Kazan, director of A Streetcar Named Desire and East of Eden, which is James Dean's first film, goes before the House of Un-American Activities Committees and just sells out like everybody he knows, essentially. Yeah, no, it sucks. And Miller at that time is literally in Salem researching the witch trials, doesn't have the idea for the Crucible ready yet, but he knows it's going to be something. And then he gets the telegram about his friend and that a lot of his personal friends are now like suspects. And he's like, well, I know, he says, well, I know what I'm writing now. In fact, he sent Kazan a screenplay to like a play once that he wrote and sent it to Kazan. And Kazan said, do you want me to direct? And he says, no, this is a play. And it's a play about basically a guy who's trying to like ruin a union getting defeated. And Miller said, no, this is just what I think of stool pigeons like you. Around this time also he meets Miss Marilyn Monroe in 1951 and has an affair with her for a while, and they remain in contact. That will become important later. He does stay married through this. It's a secret affair by all accounts. At this point, he writes The Crucible. 1953, it premieres. And then on 1954, it's going to premiere in London, and he's getting on the plane to go, and he hears, sir, your passport has been revoked.
Oh, dear.
And he has been summoned very shortly after to the House of Un-American Activities Committee. So, you know, the play almost like being brought into existence in real time. But before we get into that, just to talk about The Crucible itself, the play was performed first at the Martin Beck Theater on Broadway, premiered on January 22nd, starring E.G. Marshall, Beatrice Straight, and Madeline Sherwood. And honestly, Miller was like pretty disappointed by its original release. The original director, Jed Harris, Was a very classical director. He said this play, he wanted this play to be almost mechanical. He would not let the actors look at each other when they performed. They had to look straight forward at all times, arms stuck. Like they wanted them to be like just straight delivery. It was like, it was a choice for him.
The basically, hell?
Yeah,
do
bad
you
idea.
Have a, do you have a play as deeply as, you know, as deeply rooted on like interpersonal relations as this, you know, like personal grudges, personal, you know, affairs, right, you know, family, and not have the fucking, like, I mean, that's the soul of a play, right? That you get tied up in, you get tied up in other people in ways that, you know, lead you to compromise or not compromise, you know, your values and other, and, you know, your vouch for people's character at incorrect times, you know, like,
yeah, Jed Harris basically had this idea that it was like, gonna let the work speak for itself, but it's just not, it wasn't the medium. Miller was not particularly impressed, neither were the critics. But then it gets actually another release by a lesser known, I forget who, but by a lesser known director. And it's emotional and dark, and it's his most successful play. It absolutely takes off. It would just a couple years later be adapted into a French / East German collaborative film adapted by, 2 weeks ago we mentioned him, Jean-Paul Sartre. I always have trouble with his name. In this version, it is all the people who are accused are the like lower class people, basically. And it's like a class thing.
I mean, essentially, yeah, that's what's going on.
Yeah, in this, it's even more explicitly like class-based in the play. And then it would later have some more film adaptations. We already mentioned the 1996 one with Daniel Day-Lewis and Winona Ryder. And the screenplay of that was adapted by Miller himself. He received Oscar nominations, widely regarded film, really good, highly recommend the movie. And then also the Crucible, you know, we could talk about its legacy, but you know, it's widely loved. One of my favorite things about it is that apparently it was very common as an act of protest that was technically legal to put on shows of the Crucible in Chile after Pinochet's coup. And I things like that's been very common as a form of like of just barely legal protest, basically.
Well, maybe
like
they'll
as a
do that
sign.
In Argentina now.
Maybe they will. But let's talk about Miller. He is getting in trouble. He goes to get a new passport because he says, surely there's been a problem. And he gets told he's been subpoenaed for three reasons. First, the Crucible. Second, his old communist ties. And third, because he was writing a movie called The Hook, and his boss told him, change the gangsters to communists. And he said, no, that doesn't work in my plot. This is a mafia drama about a port and like infighting and like this union that's trying to fight back against these gangsters.
Williams plays Peter Pan at one point.
That would be amazing.
Sorry.
imagine if that movie had communists. So he said no, and they were like, well, you're anti-American. This is also around the same time that he leaves his wife and marries Marilyn Monroe. And she goes with him to the House of Un-American Activities Committee. Their romance, by the way, lasts about a year. It's like a whirlwind, very emotional.
And what a year.
Yeah, pretty extreme. And we can mention that in a second. But just to finish the HUAC story, he goes before them and he's told, oh, you won't have to sell anybody out. We just want to hear about your political doings. And what do you know? He is told for Congress, you have to tell us some names. And he says, quote, I could not use the name of another person and bring trouble on him, end quote, which is almost directly a quote from The Crucible. He contempt of Congress. He is fined significantly and is sentenced to prison. And he basically narrowly gets the sentence overturned by a sympathetic judge after a lot of public outcry. Really hurts his career for years, though. He does not have many successful theatrical releases for many years after this. His plays that do come out, they get boycotted by right-wing groups for the rest of his life. Even like well into the 90s, he was getting like attacked by like right-wingers and stuff like that. He took a very principled stand. It was very difficult. He did not sell anyone out. He was not a communist, but he was one of the few principled centrists who's like, I don't like communism and I don't like capitalism. When he said he was an enlightened centrist, he really did say like, I don't stand for either of these things. he was like pretty loud critic of the Soviet Union and stuff like that. But he's like that. He said, I still don't think people should go to prison for supporting it, because I believe people should be able to do what they want. And he also said, he has a quote where he says, capitalism also doesn't get to talk. They produce Nazi Germany and fascist Italy. So like, I don't think capitalism is any better. I mean, he definitely had some like reductive opinions and incorrect opinions. Some of that just influenced by the information he was presented at the time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so much of what we understand historically about the Soviet Union, at least in particular, pre-World War II, comes from, you know, I hesitate to even call it scholarship, but, you know, it comes from scholarship from the Nazis, right? And from a deliberate, like, hatchet job by Franz Halder that we won't get into here. But yeah, you know, it is something that's been unpacked over decades, you know. But, you know, quite apart from that, yeah, Arthur Miller is somebody who, within the sphere of information that he had access to, knew injustice when he saw it and wasn't afraid to call it out on his, you know, on what was nominally his side.
In fact, he's like happy to, he travels to China and puts on productions of Death of a Salesman there and stuff like that. Like he's,
oh yeah, that was really big in Beijing, wasn't it?
Oh yeah. And he refuses to like really, there were some showings of The Crucible where people thought it was like commentary on the Cultural Revolution. And he was like, I'm sorry. He was like, sorry to tell you, wrote this thing in the 50s. But anyway, kind of interesting. But want to note about Monroe, she converts to Judaism for him. She has a weird quote where she's like, I identify with the Jews because they're always oppressed like me or something, something along those lines. Very strange. She kind of gets it to like, she's like, maybe I'll just become a housewife and leave Hollywood. At this time, she is addicted to pills. There was a narrative for a while that Miller got her addicted to painkillers. That's not accurate. By all accounts, Arthur Piller, terrible. by all accounts, that doesn't seem to be accurate. There is a lot of details about their relationship that are foggy, and like he wrote an autobiography and some people are like, well, that's not a great source, but like people around them said like they had a good relationship even after the divorce. They basically had like sort of an informal divorce where they just separated. And her last movie was a movie that he helped write, The Misfits, 1961, which he said is one of the most miserable times he's ever had making that movie. She at this point is very far gone. She dies shortly after the film. Which is, and he makes the play After the Fall, about her and the end of her life in 1964.
Wow.
Massively controversial play. I've not watched it. Some people are like, this is an amazing tribute. It's been called everything from sexist to people saying that people who call it sexist don't understand the play. I've heard everything up and down. I'm not making a stance because I have not seen the play, so please do not come for me. I have no idea, but it is apparently something that got a lot of flack. Oh, also the woman who opened up and played Marilyn Monroe, apparently she was considered fucking amazing. Apparently she absolutely killed it. So you know, props to the production of it, but who knows about the play itself. But it was another thing in Miller's currently controversial life that was once again controversial.
Yeah, and you know, if you're going to live another 40 years after a whirlwind romance with Marilyn Monroe, like that's the way to process it, you know.
Sure. I mean, he would write more about it too, you know, in articles in his autobiography. He wrote quite a bit. He was president of like the International Association of Writers called PEN. He wrote a play called The Price. He was a big Eugene McCarthy guy in 1968, trying to primary Lyndon B. Johnson and end the Vietnam War. He was, in fact, a delegate at the fateful 1968 Democratic National Convention.
Oh, wow.
Fighting to overturn the Lyndon B. Johnson nomination. You know, again, not like a communist, but certainly on the right side of things when it came to that, because he was just like, he would like get an issue, right? He would be like, free speech, I'm all in on this right now. He would get an issue. Vietnam, it's bad. I'm all in on this right now. That's kind of like what he did. And he would proceed to basically do that on different issues for the rest of his life.
There is a, and I won't get into it here, but there's a family story of mine that essentially through a weird chain reaction, Lyndon Johnson managed to keep my grandfather from serving in Korea. He was going to be in the Marines and he ended up getting his Navy commission reinstated because he'd given it before. And he didn't serve in Korea. So in a weird way, Lyndon Johnson is the reason that we are having this conversation now on Spotify and wherever you get your streaming.
Lyndon B. Johnson, come on the pod. We will have questions for you about your policies in Indonesia,
yes,
and Vietnam,
yes,
and
please,
otherwhere.
And please don't take out your cock.
Please keep it in the pants. Yeah, yeah, please do. So, like I said, the only thing I had to note about China, aside from what I already said, is someone says to him, isn't it said to him, reportedly, isn't it a shame that we lost China, referring to it going communist? And he says, yes, in the same way a flea loses an elephant. And I thought that was funny. Because he was like, yeah, what do you mean you lost China? Like, as if it's yours to begin with. This is a bigger country than you. This is an older country. Like, he, that was his point. Kept writing lots of essays, lots of awards. Honestly, like, go to his awards section on his Wikipedia. It's unbelievable. I can't even begin to get into it. I mean, like, he was incredibly loved. I can't even get into all the plays and essays and whatever he wrote. He was a scholar. He wrote about writing. He wrote about the politics of writing. He would do classes. This guy was incredibly, you know, wrote very regularly, even when there were periods of him being less popular. Notably beefed with Christopher Hitchens over whether the Monica Lewinsky scandal was like the Salem witch trials, because that's what Arthur Miller said. He was like, this is reminding me of the Salem witch trials all over again. This is a wild goose chase. Beefed with Christopher Hitchens and then a bunch of like conservative groups going into the early 2000s.
And if anybody is going to have the audacity to beef with Arthur fucking Miller, it was Christopher Hitchens.
Yeah, exactly. Last play ever was called Finishing the Picture, which is actually quite a good last name. 2004 is when it came out. 4 months before Miller died. And it is just in straight up an autobiography about shooting the film The Misfits, which again, he remembered as the most miserable time of his life. He said he was asked, is it autobiographical? And he said, in the sense that it is the shadow of myself on the stage. Like, he felt like it was like a warped version of himself, but him and Marilyn Monroe and stuff. So it was a well-liked show. And he would die 4 months afterwards at the age of 89. So, you know, lived to be quite old, and, you know, again, quite successful. But, you know, The Crucible is his most widely regarded work. Second, I mean, like, Death of the Salesman definitely, you know, has a lot of clout, but The Crucible is its most staged work. And I had an interesting quote that he said about why he felt he had to write The Crucible. I found this interesting. Quote, and he wrote this in the 90s. Quote, The Crucible was an act of desperation. Much of my desperation branched out, I suppose, from a typical Depression-era trauma. The blow struck on the mind by the rise of European fascism and the brutal anti-Semitism it had brought to power. But by 1950, when I began to think of writing about the hunt for Reds in America, I was motivated in some great part by the paralysis that had set in among many liberals who, despite their discomfort with the Inquisitor's violation of civil rights, were fearful, and with good reason, of being identified as covert communists if they should protest too strongly. And then he would go on a little later in the article to talk about why he identified with John Proctor. He said, all this I understood. I had not approached the witchcraft out of nowhere or from purely social and political considerations. My own marriage of 12 years was teetering, and I knew more than I wished to know about where the blame lay, and that's referring to himself. That John Proctor, the sinner, might overturn his paralyzing personal guilt and become the most forthright voice against the madness around him was a reassurance to me, and I suppose an inspiration. And so he, while researching the Salem witch trials, has all this going on and is literally reading through these old records, and he comes across this guy, John Proctor, and these other characters, and yeah, they are real people. He changes their age, he changes their story, he invents things about them. He admits that as much himself at the beginning of the book, though some of this is true. He cuts John Proctor's age in half just to make it a character to make more sense. But nevertheless, he did read one court transcription where he said a girl who had used to work for John Proctor, Abigail Williams, started to touch him and then pulled her hand away and screamed as if burned with fire. And he said that compelled him. And he thought, what was their interpersonal dynamic? What was going on there? And then John Proctor refused to confess what maybe was going on in his heart. And then probably through a bit of his own projection, he was like, I wonder if he was cheating on his wife. and you know, Miller admits as such in his 90s essay on The Crucible. And that is my presentation on Miller, Joss's presentation on the Salem witch trials. And we are like You know, I know we've not really even gotten into the text, but there is just a lot of history here. And especially considering we're a socialist show, we would be doing a massive disservice not to talk about the history around this text, which was completely undiscussed when I performed this show at my high school. We really just did not get into the history of it because, of course, anti-communism is the religion of the United States.
It is. Yes. Yes. I mean, it is very much a show about where individuals individuals succeed and transcend what institutions stumble and fall on, right? It is a show about people, you know, I mean, straight up John Proctor coming to that confession, finding his goodness, as his wife says at the end, you know, it is something that the people who identify themselves with the colonial authority in Salem fail to do. Indeed, it's something that the authority, I mean, you know, part of the reason that the religious authorities of the day didn't come down on the hysteria of Salem harder is because there was just other shit going on, right? There was King William's War in the Americas, right? That front of the Nine Years' War, which is the great power conflict in Europe, right? There was, they were contending with the Native Americans whose land they were colonizing, right? There was this religious hysteria that was followed with interest by the ministers of the day, but which wasn't, we wouldn't see justice from until decades after. It was in this century even that the final victim of all this was fully exonerated.
Mm, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So the play is, I mean, in the this copy that we're reading, this publication that we're reading is was very popular to read as well, because not only is there, you know, obviously you're just classic play, you know, character says the line, there is quite a bit of like very detailed stage direction, and then there is just summary then in analysis written in by Miller all around it. Like, he just will describe Reverend Paris in detail, say things like, at the time of these events Paris was in his middle 40s, in history he cut a villainous path, and on and on and on. He'll go on for paragraphs. And that's obviously not something that would come into the play itself, but also makes this a sort of a meatier text to discuss as a book than just a show. Though, of course, you know, the context of the show changes the story dramatically, depending on how it's portrayed.
Yeah, I mean, you see it right here in Act One, right? Again, very detailed stage directions. It goes into a long narration about Salem and about the sociopolitical conditions prevailing thereat at that time. And the way he describes Paris's space intrigues me. You know, at the back door, a door opens on the landing of the stairway to the ground floor. The room gives off an air of clean spareness. The roof rafter is exposed. The wood colors are raw and unmellowed. You know, from the beginning, I think he's putting us in the context of, okay, this is the residence of somebody in theory with nothing to hide, right?
Mm-hmm. It's also notable, this is just, you know, I can't divorce this from the context of having like been in the show. The guy we had play Reverend Paris was almost 6'10" and thin as a whip, built like Jack Skellington. And so he literally like hunched over and kind of walked around and had these big clothes hanging off of him. And it's a phenomenal, I mean, I wouldn't want to see Paris any other way, because
What's this? There's witches in the town. What's this?
Yeah.
What's this? We're tearing people down. Sorry.
He literally played Fagin in their production of Oliver the year before. Like, he's that type of character. He would go on to play Monsieur Thénardier in Les Mis. Very much that kind of guy.
Wow.
And he didn't play Paris exactly the same way, but you know, Paris is this guy who is this, I mean, he's a minister, but he's a educated minister. He went to Harvard and he's going to tell you about it. But he also spent time doing trading of some sort. He didn't say what, in Barbados.
Mm-hmm.
Hard to imagine any of that was ethical, especially because he brought a slave back with him, Tituba, a slave woman from Barbados who lives in Salem. And, you know, he's this controversial minister at the center of the town. Controversial. Why? Because he's always demanding more money. He demanded the deed to like the church and the house he stays in. He is interested in property, not God. So like from the beginning, this obsession with property and rights and material is going to spark this conspiracy.
It's the infringement indeed of the sacred on the profane, right? And profane, not even in the sense of, oh, this is a swear, right? But profane in the sense of the temporal, in the sense of the non-religious, right? And it's, okay, here's this up and coming religious authority that is accruing to himself something of the material, right? Something, you know, again, private property, right? With which he can act politically.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But, you know, at the show opens with Paris alongside his daughter, Betty. And Betty has been struck by some illness, supposedly. And this is after Paris went out into the woods and caught her and some other girls dancing out in the woods with Tituba and with Paris's niece, who also lives with him, Abigail Williams. And at that point, Betty collapses, and they had it looked like they were doing some kind of ritual, at least to Paris. And I mean, a point is made by Miller, even in the book, is saying, yeah, maybe Tituba was doing some kind of, like, from her people, what would be seen as witchcraft by these Christians. Mm-hmm. Basically, so what? Like, you know, like, exactly. she may have been, she was singing songs of her people. Is it possible that they would have seen that as witchcraft? Yeah, they would probably see as anything a non-white person was doing that was religious as witchcraft. That these people are fundamentally racist.
Yes.
And you see that coming into play immediately. And also there is an interesting quote from the summary. It says, "The parochial snobbery of these people was partly responsible for their failure to convert the Indians. Probably they also preferred to take land from heathens rather than from fellow Christians. At any rate, very few Indians were converted, and the Salem folk believed that the virgin forest was the devil's last preserve, his home base and the citadel of his final stand. To the best of their knowledge, the American forest was the last place on earth that was not paying homage to God." And yeah, it's immediately like, we have to conquer this. And any crossing over into this forest by these girls is seen as, like, synonymous with crossing over into the land of witchery, which is the land of the other. Now, you know, the irony not lost that these people are literally the foreigners in this situation.
Oh, yeah, it's precisely that sort of insularity and that aggressive, you know, I'm not touching you sort of insularity, right? Mm-hmm. That we talked about way back in our Left Behind episode, right? I remember they had final exams when I was in high school in this Pentecostal church down the road from where I went to school. And to get to the fellowship hall where they were administering these tests, we had to walk, you know, you go down the hall and we walk by this big old bulletin board, right? And on that bulletin board is a map of the world. And on that map of the world is a, like, big, like, square, rectangle, region from about Morocco and North Africa to all the way through China and India, right? And it said, oh, in this space, 90% of people pray to heathen gods with no power to save. And we got to go out there and do this, that, and the other, you know? And it is, as Arthur Miller says, you know, that air of innate resistance, even of persecution, right? Even when you are, you know, as you say, coming into the world and seizing this land, you have to constantly paint yourself as the victim, as the put upon, right? As, you know, the sole bearers of the light against this encroaching darkness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man. But I can only imagine how bad it would be if people like this were able to, you know, found a country that would exist for hundreds of years and have run the world's biggest military. I'm glad that never happened.
Yeah, probably won't.
Probably not likely. Anyway, these accusations start flying. Everybody's getting concerned. This town, you know, they don't get to do a lot of fun stuff in the town. The very fact that girls were dancing is a scandal. And before I go on, there's definitely an element of, like, this, like, patriarchal structure here as well. The idea that these girls would be out in the woods dancing, the idea that, like, women in any way would express themselves. It comes back very consistently to this. Abigail at one point even, like, insinuates that her uncle has, like, sexual feelings for her in this. And she's like, is that what you're doing here? And he denies it, of course, but it's left up to our minds to be like, well, what has she gone through? It's not clear.
And in particular, she is somebody who is very aware, very recently and acutely aware of her sexuality in a way that, others, and you know, she's not wrong to insinuate this in a way that other women in the area perhaps are not or choose to ignore.
Right. And I mean, for the reason of this very hierarchical society where, you know, obviously there's the hierarchy of class, there is the hierarchy of the church, but then there is still the hierarchy of men over women in a very, very systemic way in this, obviously that continues to this day. And but there is it's a very rigid structure in this town. So this idea of these women expressing themselves in any way, is also tied in with witchcraft. And in fact, a lot of the accusations of witchcraft that we see historically were just lesbians. They would just be oh, they're witches. Because women are having pleasure with other women. This has to be witchcraft. I've never seen a woman.
Yeah. Happy or, you know, and, you know, indeed, many of them also were just older unmarried women, or indeed younger unmarried women. Right. Who didn't necessarily fit into the economic structure of the area that they were in. Yeah. And of course, again, it provides the perfect cover, as Miller goes into in this narration, for people to say, yeah, this woman came and into my room and she was sitting on me and suffocating me and this, that, or the other. And, you know, to be able to say that with a straight face and not have people wait, so you were with this woman who you were married to? Can we go back and it becomes, as Miller says, you know, patriotic and holy for somebody to say, oh, this person came and seduced me, right?
So, you know, at this point, the town's all in an uproar. The doctor can't figure out what's wrong. And why is that? It's because his daughter is stressed out, and basically she's putting on a show here because she doesn't want to get in trouble. She's if I keep my eyes closed, my dad can't get mad at me. I'm that's essentially it. Because when he leaves the room, she's Abigail, what's happening?
he's a reverend. His vision is based on movement.
Yeah, exactly. And so it becomes a situation where Abigail's okay, well, we're going to fix this because, you know, I know that I'm in trouble here. And it turns out this whole business was actually Abigail's idea, and she was conjuring a charm, quote unquote, having told Tituba to do it, to kill Goody Proctor. Women are called, that are wives are called Goody in this. Yeah, I know that's an old thing.
For good wife, yeah.
I love that, Goody. And there's one woman called Goody Good. Awesome. So cool. Bring this language back, TBH. But no, yeah, and that's why. And Joss, do you want to go into why Abigail has this vendetta against Goody Proctor?
Oh, yes, because Abigail,
this is important.
I mean, we're not going to mince words here. John Proctor's a bit of a groomer. He is an older man who has dabbled around outside of his marriage. You know, of course, Elizabeth Proctor has had a difficult pregnancy, and she's recovering from that. And while that's going on, John Proctor and Abigail get it on.
Who was basically a live-in farmhand at the time.
Yeah, she was a live-in farmhand, and that's why she was dismissed from the Proctor's service by Elizabeth, because she was sleeping with John Proctor, or rather, you know, John Proctor was sleeping with her. And she believes to this day that John has feelings for her. John, of course, does not. He, in fact, bitterly regrets their affair, though not in principle, or not in the principle that we would like him to regret it. And so here now is her saying, "Okay, well, we're gonna try every avenue that we can to get him back in my embrace," because John, indeed, you know, has introduced her, from her perspective, to this state of being aware of her sexuality and accepting of her sexuality in ways that she had repressed.
Mm-hmm. And you go to see how, like, you know, and you know, Abigail is certainly a major villain of this book. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly the fact that she in this situation was taken advantage of does not excuse the mass murder she proceeds to do. Mm-hmm. However, it also shows how these conditions are created. It also shows that she had this very, you know, this, I say, simple goal. She basically, having been taught that, well, she had sex, so now she was impure, she's like, well, I have to be with the man I lost my virginity to. Mm-hmm. What do? I guess I got to kill this woman. Like, it is actually, interestingly enough, the natural progression of the logic taught to her by the society in Salem. And so she is trying to look for power outside that power structure because she's like, what else am I to do? And now Abigail is known as kind of a bit of a troublemaker. She's known to at least twice in the last year have been thrown from church for unstoppably laughing during prayer, which is a very funny thing to imagine. Like, she just cannot stop laughing. Not sure what's up there. Funny idea.
Yeah. And again, you know, it's a society where, like, they didn't celebrate Christmas, right? They didn't dance, right? There's all this, you know, these are the weird Christians that, you know, the weird Christians in Britain thought were too weird.
Right, exactly. And so it creates a situation. So then when people start coming in town, and Abigail's like, okay, well, I've got to turn this the right direction. And now Proctor's here. And now, you know, the older people of the town are around, and the busybodies, they really start getting interested. Notably, it's like Thomas Putnam, like a guy who's like well off, but is insecure about his status and people like that.
His brother-in-law was turned down as a minister of Salem in favor of Paris. So he has a vendetta there.
Like this kind of upper strata who are kind of dejected. And so who do they immediately start picking on? You know, they're going to start picking on Tituba, the slave. They're going to start picking on these girls. They're going to start picking on, you know, basically like a homeless woman. But they, because of this situation of this insanity, and because they're staying in this girl's ear, did you see witches? Did you see witches? Was there witchcraft? Who did you see? Where was the Satanism? Where were whatever? Insisting on it. And because it's like, okay, I'm going to get out of trouble. And the way that one lie turns into another lie, the classic Fib from Outer Space, Larry Boy episode. It grows, and then all of a sudden there's accusations being thrown around, and a priest has been brought in, Reverend Hale, who is supposed to be an expert on the demonic arts. And
this is interesting guy to me. So right as we're getting into the grievances that these people have with each other, right? What do we learn about Putnam's wife Anne, right? We learn that she is mother to seven children that she's like miscarried, or like, you know, they have suddenly died in infancy, right? Mm-hmm. And she's like, well, Tituba knows how to speak to the dead, right? She has this like Barbados magic. And so that's the thing. She wants, I don't quite recall. Did she want one of her kids to talk to Tituba about this?
Yeah. She sent her only living daughter to Tituba to talk to her.
Yes, because this is a person who has the power to speak to the dead, which is interesting to me, right? Because nominally, yes, that's like of the devil or whatever, but it's somebody who feels, okay, like I'm desperate enough that I can go to this and defend myself to a priest about it, right? It's somebody who arrogates to herself the right within this context to redefine what's sacred and what's profane.
Yes. And it ends up bringing Mr. Reverend Hale to town, the expert of the defense against the dark arts teacher himself. He comes in with all these books. I love it. Hale says, pray you someone take these. And Paris says, oh my, they're heavy. And Hale says, they must be. He pauses. They are weighted with authority. So I'm like, oh my God. He like kind of like shakes off his like trench coat or whatever. Like, bro thinks he's like in Supernatural or something, coming like to kill Hale. Demons. No, I think he's the most interesting character in the book, or in the play, because Hale comes with this, you know, and like Josh said, this is not a situation where these people are, you know, fooling about the fact they believe in demons. They 100% believe in demons and witches. We cannot quite get inside their brain space, even if you are like a believer in the supernatural, to be in the brain space of these people who like lived in this like borderline feudal, like emerging capitalist, but still like very religious culture, this like where they lived and breathed this stuff, to like put yourself in that mind space. It's a very difficult thing to do. It's a very alien world. So like, this is very real to them. There is the line in it where he says, we cannot look for superstition in this. The devil is precise. Like that he says, we can't look for superstition. We're looking for the devil. Like, it's because those things are not on different sides of the aisle to him here. Hale will eventually come to regret his role in all this, but he does see himself as kind of this expert. He sees himself as this guy who, like, he's read the books. He knows the lore.
Yeah, and you know, not to play spot the liberal in a time where you know liberalism hasn't been invented yet, but like, I mean, you know, it's the context that Miller is writing from, right?
If this I'm gonna say Miller's playing spot the liberal, so why can't we?
exactly. Yes, you know, Hale is somebody who has tied himself to a power structure, to a religious authority that predicates its authority in part on the combating of these supernatural influences, right? So when that's taken to its illogical conclusion, you know, he is powerless to stop what he has lent legitimacy to. You know, because you know, he himself does leave open the possibility of salvation for Tituba and them. You know, he himself doesn't really get into the thought terminating aspect of all these accusations.
Just another thing, like Hale is described on page 37, at least in my book, as with a tasty love of intellectual pursuit, he delivers his lines. Like, I just the way he talks, and it says. As here is all the invisible world caught, defined, and calculated. In these books, the devil stands stripped of all his brute disguises. Here are your familiar spirits, your incubi and succubi, your witches that go by land, air, and sea, your wizards of the night and of the day. Have no fear now, we shall find him out if he has come among us. And I mean to crush him utterly as if he has shown his face. And then it's asked, will it hurt the child? And he says, I cannot tell. If she is truly in the devil's grip, we may have to rip and tear to get her free. Like, he is like this character who's like walking in with this like purpose, whatever. Like, he, like it says earlier, he sees himself as like a doctor coming to cure his patient, right? Mm-hmm. He doesn't have this idea of this cascading effect where it's going to kill a lot of people. He is like coming to make an incision. He is coming to prove himself. He is, if honestly, like growing his own reputation. And it also makes it's, and he also is the one who plants in the mind of this girl from the beginning. He's saying, does someone afflict you? Do you think maybe it's a man, or is it an animal, or is it a, and he's like feeding her ideas. Like, and that's like the nature of, like, you know, people that manipulate other people. Like, you know, if you want to give somebody a false memory, you know, that's a classic thing. Like on police reports, police want to plant like guilt in someone, it's like, did the guy look like this? And to a traumatized person or a scared person, it can be very easy for them to say yes. Memory is a fickle thing. We've all done that to ourselves before, probably. Oh, yeah. And much less to this like child with this figure of authority speaking to her.
Oh yeah, yeah, no, like it's, you know, whence the confessions in court, you know, whence the confessions under, you know, this or that kind of duress, you know, whether it's prison conditions or, you know, just being surrounded by people who are yelling at you, you know, as indeed Betty is later in this scene when she has that fit.
And then, of course, the big accusation against Tituba. Abigail realizes, okay, I got to go all in on this. And so she does this whole like, she comes to me at night and makes me conjure blood. And then Tituba.
Right, because initially Abigail is you know, keeping, you know, while the adults are out of the room, right? Abigail's keeping the others in line. Like, listen, this is all Tituba's fault. We didn't do anything.
Yeah, some of the other girls will like Mary and stuff like that will like kind of convince themselves that it's real. Abigail is, I think you are supposed to never at any point believe Abigail has bought into any of this. Abigail is completely cynical. She is actually one of maybe the only character in this, aside from like John Proctor, who is like, witches are bullshit completely. Yeah. I do not believe in them at all. Her and John Proctor for on different sides of the aisle here, but
yeah, which again, you know, you feel for her, you know, because she has in that, you know, tragic sort of way, she has this enlightenment of her own value, like as a person, you know, like she's not only cast out of Elizabeth's home, right, but nobody else is taking her into their service. It's not entirely clear why, but she says, look, you know, they want slaves, not such as I, right, you know, and you know, we can get into, you know, we don't have to get into the divide between, you know, what she thinks is worth her versus what she thinks is worth a slave in terms of work, right? But, you know, she's somebody who, you know, she's somebody who thinks, wait a minute, I have value and I am not letting that go.
Absolutely. And then, so of course, Tituba just is like, well, I'm going to I'm going to live. I'm not dying for these people. Mm-hmm. And you know, why should she? So she basically tells a story of what happened. She, and you know, it's unclear. You don't get inside the head of Tituba here, whether she is being completely cynical or whether she is taken up in the hysteria ultimately. And that's the fun thing about a play, right? A director could go either way. They could say Tituba is actually brilliant and she knows how to stay alive. Or you could say Tituba is a woman who is a very traumatized woman who can be swayed very easily. You could play it either way. Mm-hmm. Like you could play very many characters in this. You could go on and play a Danforth that doesn't believe in this at all. A Hawthorne that doesn't believe in this at all. You could play a Proctor who is actually scared of the witches. You can do all in saying, oh, I don't believe, but that's the fun thing about a play. And then that's why, you know, it has these different interpretations, which is why we're also, you know, on dangerous grounds, you know, doing our own interpretation at all here. But, you know, what are we here for? We've got our mics, so we might as well spin our yarns. But they start accusing, like, basically people of the town that are accusable, the lower strata, a homeless woman, a woman known to be a drinker and a scoundrel. These people, they start throwing out. So, like, who are the first people accused? Notably, a black woman and the lower class people. And that's not a mistake. And it will spin past there, but the oppression starts at the beginning. It starts at the bottom of the social hierarchy. Because if it had started with, oh, I accuse Reverend Paris, well, it would have stopped then and there. It would have that would have never been allowed. I accuse Judge Danforth. I'm sure everyone would have been happier, but no, that would have not happened. But you accuse Tituba, you accuse, you know, you accuse the woman who begs for food. Well, maybe you can do that, you know. And that's the end of Act One. The curtain falls.
Yes, the curtain falls, and it rises on Act Two.
The dynamic of Elizabeth and Proctor, Elizabeth being Proctor's wife. And what do we think, like, of Proctor as a guy? Like, what are your opinions on Proctor? Because it's very clear how much that Miller is, like, identifying with Proctor, and he makes no pretensions about that himself.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, Proctor is, I mean, he's a salt of the earth kind of guy, right? Mm-hmm. He says, you know, we vote by name, Mr. Putnam, you know, not by acreage, right? You know, the measure of a man is his actions, right? And his character, right? Not any sort of, economic or marker of wealth or prosperity, right? Mm-hmm. He is, you know, by all accounts, an honest man. And yet he is a liar. He is an adulterer. You know, he has these base passions that he indulged when he, you know, introduced a 17-year-old girl to sex. Right. Yeah. And, but that's the thing, right? It's John Proctor is, not supposed to be a perfect man. He's supposed to be somebody with principles who in various situations for various reasons compromises them, you know? And that's the thing, right? Such a person sometimes runs afoul of much deeper, much more dangerous institutional rot. And what does he do with that?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, like, it's notably, this is a guy who helped hang the church, like the current frame, build the current frame of the church.
Yes.
You know, this is a guy who is, but this is also a guy who, if he's mad at the pastor, is completely willing to just not go to church. This is a guy who is living in this society, but he doesn't quite know all his commandments, but he tends to follow. It is actually kind of funny. He forgets the thou shalt not commit adultery when he's trying to remember his commandments.
He knows the other nine. And then he's like, oh yeah, you know, well, my wife and I know our commandments, like, between us, like all of them. But
and
they've
seen him and his wife have kind of a, like, you know, when you see them at first, you have kind of a nice dynamic. Like, they have, to at least a little bit of an extent, resolved some of the tension, not completely, but like, this is not a fresh wound. This is, there's some coldness, but they're still like, oh, well, how was your day? Oh, we're going to get some flowers in the house. Well, how are the kids? Well, they're like kind of they're not completely at each other's throats, but there is this unresolved wound, and Proctor feels judged by his wife, who is by all accounts like a perfect woman. And, you know, which is an interesting thing. But of course, Proctor will kind of realize later, like, his own confession. He'll have to confess that, because he knows he's sinned, and he'll say, oh, I know I've sinned. But he's being, interestingly enough, committing the sin of self-righteousness in confessing his sin to his wife.
Yes.
And it is only when he can abandon that self-righteousness that he can actually find that redemption.
Yeah, and he does still have, because I don't think Abigail's entirely wrong about his affection for her, right? I mean, he does have that unresolved stuff to work out about her, you know, because at first he's not willing to accuse her of fraud. Like, he's not willing to accuse her of weaponizing these accusations of witchcraft. Even though that is very abundantly clearly what she is doing. He's very defensive about it too, right? You know, I've gone tiptoe in this house all 7 months since she's gone. I've not moved from there to here without, I think, to please you, and still an everlasting funeral marches round your heart. Well, I mean, you know, of course it does. You have, you know, coming on 3 kids with this woman, and yet you, you know, you betray her trust in that way. She's going to have some lingering sort of resentment.
You know, this is another place where I kind of want to draw attention to the fact that depending on the dynamic presented in a stage production, Proctors can be more or less guilty, right? Proctor can be a guy who is genuinely like very contrite, like a very much like the preacher from like the Scarlet Letter type of character who's like literally bent under the weight of his sins, you know, this burned into his chest. Or he can be a guy who's like, fuck it, you know, like, you know, whatever, and doesn't get contrite till later. You know, in the production like that I did in high school, like they literally had Abigail kiss Proctor when he first came on stage the first time when they were alone, and Proctor only pulls away from it after like a second and a half. Like, he's definitely in it for a second. You could do that. You could have him like immediately reject it. There's different ways of doing it, and there's not a right or wrong, but it is like, regardless, Proctor has this guilt. He knows what he's done is wrong, and he is a man who is by all accounts perfect. Aside from that, in a society where nothing less than perfection is expected of you, and also it is expected of you to just lie or hide it if you are not perfect. You are expected to put on a perfect face. If you are a drinker, you deny being a drinker. If you have, you know, if you have sex outside of marriage, you deny doing that. You repress, you blame, or as we'll see in this, you blame someone else to devastate. And it ends up that Abigail's sort of vendetta against Goody Proctor now coming to fruition as she has accused Goody Proctor of witchcraft and even done this thing with their now servant or maid or whatever you want to call her. Mary has planted knitted a poppet, a little doll for Goody Proctor as a gift. And Abigail has accused her of using it for witchcraft. It's like this plan that she made. She even stabbed herself with a needle and said, "Oh, I've been stabbed by the poppet." And at this point, Reverend Hale is there. And that's where Reverend Hale starts to be like, well, this seems a little weird. This seems like a good family. And this is where like the real controversy begins, and Elizabeth gets taken away. And at this point, Proctor's like, okay, I'm going to have to confront the court. I have no choice.
Yes. Yes. Cause yeah, by this time there have been many more people taken in. You know, there are the, there's the 14 people that are set to hang. Like and yeah, Proctor calls very, very correctly, you know, despite his failings, you know, he sees through the various miscarriages of justice going on, right? You know, Hale says, you know, I have myself examined Tituba, and numerous others that have confessed to dealing with the devil. They've confessed it. You know, and Proctor says correctly, why not if they must hang for denying it? There are them that will swear to anything before they'll hang. Have you never thought of that? And it gives Hale pause. It gives Hale pause because genuinely he, he's thought of it, you know, but he's caught up in this, right? He's caught up in this carrying out of his authority that requires him to do something that's fundamentally immaterial.
It is also here where you find out that basically the most perfect woman in the town, Rebecca Nurse, has been charged as well, which is important because it's like, if anyone can be charged, it should not be able to be charged. It's Rebecca Nurse on the grounds of morality. But she can be. People are being charged for their land. People are being charged for petty vendettas. And obviously, in this case, for basically to settle like a sexual and romantic score. And at this point, Proctor's putting together a team, you know, because he's got Giles Corey and Francis Nurse, the husbands that of whose wives were taken away as well. And he's like, all right, three of us, we're going in.
I love Giles Corey because he's been in and out of court, he says, like 30 times. And so he knows all the procedure, right? He knows all the language, right? And he can argue from sun up to sundown.
He's like a professional, like sues you for like insurance money guy, like set back in his days. And he's like won like every case. He, in fact, tells Judge Danforth, yeah, your father actually gave me some money back in the day when I won a case, when I got like, you know, something to do with a horse or whatever. And he's like, did he tell you? And Danforth is like, no, why would he? But yeah. It is interesting.
He and like, you know, all this, but as we'll see, you know, all the strength of Giles's expertise with the court, of Giles's, you know, personal belligerence that brings him up to this moment. I mean, ultimately, it pales before Proctor's own shortcomings that he hasn't overcome yet. You know, I mean, Hale asked him straight up, okay, like you have this suspicion on Abigail and on her testimony, on the testimony of people who confessed to witchcraft, you know, prove it, right? Was there murder done perhaps and never brought to light? Abomination, some secret blasphemy that sinks to heaven. And that's the thing, right? Proctor can't admit to adultery, right? Because, I mean, you know, the tragedy of all this is that when you're accused of diabolical sins, like, you can't even admit to such human ones as might save you, right? You cling to your humanity when the world indeed has dematerialized what's going on, has made a demon of you and other people.
And it's at this point where he tells Mary, you're going to come with me. We're going to lay everything bare to the court. I don't care if they find out. And then he has this very dramatic moment where she's like, I'm not going to do it. And he throws her to the ground and he says, make your peace with it. Now hell and heaven grapple on our backs and all our old pretenses ripped away. Make your peace. Peace. It is a providence and no great change. We are only what we always were, but naked now. I naked and the wind, God's icy wind will blow. And then the curtain falls. You know, you gotta have this moment of Proctor, like, I mean, this borderline like Shakespearean, like he's got his fists clenched, like he's gonna go confront the court. But of course, he's also not quite ready to be fully naked yet, right? Because he's gonna go and confess Mary Warren's sins. Mm-hmm. He's gonna so say, yeah, so we're gonna completely own up because, yeah, Mary's a liar. He's not actually ready to come fully clean to the court.
Exactly.
So there is the continued irony, which is also notably Arthur Miller criticizing himself, because what did he say? He's like, he says, when I was writing this play, my marriage was falling apart and I had a sinking suspicion whose fault that was.
Yes. Yes. And again, you know, you're in that position of, all right, I'm not a perfect person and I have to reckon with that in order to fight this greater imperfection, you know, this greater contradiction, which is the subject of Act Three. And, you know, again, we see that contradiction laid bare, right, with Judge Hathorne interrogating Corey in court, right? Martha, you know, Giles's wife, Martha. She says, as we mentioned, I'm innocent to a witch. I know not what a witch is. How do you know then that you are not a witch? If I were, I would know it. Which notably, that is taken directly from history. That is actual, those things were actually said in a court of law.
Oh man. And yeah, you have Hathorne, who is this judge who is just down to hang people. And then Danforth, who is this judge who kind of sees himself as above, played by yours truly,
very
back in the day, by our very fourth Dan. And you know, it is this courtroom scene is kind of the big, I mean, like they're, it's very quick, but this courtroom scene is this apocalyptic confrontation. It keeps building and building and building. Mm-hmm. You know, you have this moments of accusation being thrown around, and then you know, Giles Corey is brought under arrest, and Proctor bringing forth his deposition. And this is the part of the play that, like, when I was reading it back over, I remembered almost every line of. Like, I remembered this part so well. Because, like, you know, we had this big set and I was sitting up at the top of it and looking down over the courtroom. Like, this is the part of the play that also people think of the most. It's the crucible. It's this intense trial.
I love Giles just sticking it to the judges, regardless of their, you know, you're not a Boston judge yet, Hathorne. You'll not call me daft.
Yeah, exactly right.
And I also love, I mean, it's a point where, you know, the the double standards are most evident, right? You know, because again, Giles, we didn't mention this, but it's partly Giles's fault that that Mark was on trial, right? Because he said, yeah, you know, she's literate, right? She reads these weird books, you know, of one or another type. You know, he doesn't really get into the specifics of what she's reading, but you know, she's a woman who's interested in you know, esoteric knowledge of one stripe or another. Perhaps she's, I mean, you know, the thesis that the witch hunts were directed largely against like healers and like clever women is not really true. Most of the victims weren't traditional herbalists of one type or another, but you know, perhaps Martha was one such person, right? But here, right, Giles is saying, look, you're going to hang my wife on false pretenses. And like, I have hard evidence for my wife's defense, to which Danforth responds, then let him submit his evidence in proper affidavit. This in a court which is admitting, you know, spiritual spectral hearsay.
And it brings, I mean, and it gets even more intense because Proctor and these guys, they had like gotten a bunch of people in town to support them and sign a petition. And he's like, all right, arrest everybody who signed the petition. You know, the makes me think of the petition of the 2000 from Revenge of the Sith. Very similar, but it's the petition of the 92 in this case.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, Giles Corey is not going to go and build a resistance on Alderaan.
No, he is not. He is going to get crushed by rocks. And if we didn't mention it already, he is the only guy who is not able to be convicted properly because he will not say, yes, I did it, which is tantamount to guilt. And he will not say no, because that is tantamount to guilt. He will not deny or confess. So he will eventually be crushed by rocks that are trying to get him to confess. And his last words are more weight.
Yes. And, you know, the of course, the words historically, there's some discussion over what exactly he said, but the sentiment is absolutely true, you know. And the legally, it's funny, like it's not funny, but the reason partly that he does this is because at the time this is going on, according to the layout of the law, if he pleads one way or another, right, then if and when he's convicted, right, his property escheats to the state. But he never pleads, so he's not charged one way or another. So that means his property goes to his descendants.
But yeah, this courtroom scene, you know, really builds as Danforth's like, okay, I'm going to consider your deposition. I'm bringing out Abigail and her girls, and they come out.
Yeah, a deposition of like 91 people swearing to, you know, the good character of his wife.
Yeah, and
it's not nothing.
And Mary Warren making the claim that she lied about having seen all this witchcraft. And Abigail and those girls come out, and Abigail clearly has control over them from the beginning. And they're sitting, and it's Abigail and John on other sides of the courtroom. And of course, there's this tension between them from their history. There's this tension between them over the fate of Goody Proctor. And of course, the fate of the town. And this is, and again, I just keep bringing in my own experience here, but this is the scene that like, the blocking of it, we like endlessly debated exactly how we wanted everyone in the room. Where were people walking? Mm-hmm. How were people supposed to move? And there's like this whole bit on what was on mine, page 95, that this like monologue that because we kept messing up the blocking, I had to keep saying this monologue over and over and over again. Even though like it's not, you know, the most important monologue in the play. It's just a paragraph where a lot of people are moving around. So, you know, for old time's sake, I am going to read it.
Yeah.
Sit you down, children. And it says silently they sit. And at this point, people are being, you know, because like Giles and them are being taken out, and there's all that's happening. So hence the problems. Your friend, Mary Warren, has given us a deposition in which she swears that she never saw familiar spirits, apparitions, nor any manifest of the devil. She claims as well that none of you have seen these things either. Now, children, this is a court of law. The law based upon the Bible and the Bible writ by Almighty God. Forbid the practice of witchcraft and describe death as the penalty thereof. But likewise, children, the law and Bible damn all bearers of false witness. Now then, it does not escape me that this deposition may be devised to blind us. It may well be that Mary Warren has been conquered by Satan, who sends her here to distract our sacred purpose. If so, her neck will break for it. But if she speaks true, I bid you now drop your guile and confess your pretense, for a quick confession will go easier with you. Abigail Williams, rise! Is there any truth in this? And the amount of times I had to read that in high school, I remember one particular day where I swear I read that thing like 100 times. Unbelievable. Like, yeah. Anyway, when I read it in here, it was like flashbacks. But anyway, just wanted to read it off. But then he gets into it. And I have to point out here, I once saw a professional production of The Crucible. And it made me so mad because in this part, when the girls come out, they start like doing all this like weird shit, which at first it's like, okay, but like there's actually ghosts. They use stage effects to bring out ghosts. And like when the bird comes out, there's an actual bird flying around, and like it made me, and the girls actually like get possessed and stuff. And like, it made me so mad. It's like, well, this was a high value production of The Crucible. And I think they missed the entire point.
Yeah, because like, yeah, that's the thing. Like, the point is that, you know, the hysteria is the point, right? You know, we don't see this, but we are led to believe that they do, or they believe that they do, or, you know, that they're inculcating that belief in others, right? It's, I mean, I love that bit at toward the end of the act where Abigail and the rest of the girls are they've turned on Mary, right? Mary is having this fit. She's having this breakdown because she's being subjected to this questioning, right? And everything she says, the girls are copying, right? You know, as if Mary has been turned by Satan, right? And she's sending her spirit into them and possessing them. And it's like, oh my God, you're literally using this girl's trauma. You're using this girl's breakdown against her, right? In this court of law, right? And I mean, it's how delicate that situation is of being in that accusatory position, right? Because if you step out of line, then, you know, the minute you step out of line, that'll be turned on you.
Yeah. And so this scene escalates and escalates and escalates until John Proctor has to admit his own guilt.
Oh, yes.
Until, like, he has nothing else, so he just screams, Abigail. Or as they did in our version.
I have known her, sir. I have known her.
Yes. I have known her, sir. I have known her. And it's like he has to confess his own guilt to the entire court, which, of course, Danforth comes up with a test. He's like, oh, seems fair. I'll bring your wife in. And then if she admits that you had sex with her and committed a deep sin, then it'll be all good.
Yes.
And then,
yes. Yeah. Elizabeth, John Proctor's wife, who notably he has said would never tell a lie.
And she does for him, which is of course the tragic accident of all this, is that in her attempt to be more moral and attempt to be more loving, she commits, like, you know, the only sin of her life, which is lying for her lying ass husband, who then has now not told a lie. It's of course a great ironic tragedy. And then it's like, you know, and at this point, Hale is like, this is absurd. He's like calling for there to be a lawyer involved. He's like, this has moved way past anywhere. People are screaming, and Abigail starts yelling. She sees a bird flying around the room, starts repeating the words of Mary Warren and the other girls. And it's very spooky. And she's like, Abby, stop it. And the girls scream, Abby, stop it. And they're crying and falling down. I mean, it's a really nightmarish, hysterical scene that really shows the effects of mass hysteria. And then you have, you know, Proctor has this dramatic monologue. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, he does his
God is dead. A fire is burning. I hear the boot of Lucifer. I see his filthy face, and it is my face and yours, Danforth, for them that quail to bring men out of ignorance, as I have quailed, and as you quail now, when you know in all your black hearts that this be fraud. God damns our kind especially, and we will burn together.
And then at that point, Hale storms out, and Proctor says, you are pulling down heaven and raising up a whore.
Mm-hmm.
I still think, like, it's weird because it's a line that goes hard, but I also think it's like a little bit still his like shifting of blame. I guess it is Abigail's fault, but there is like an interesting, like, there is interesting still, not for a little bit, is he kind of willing to, like, before he like talks to his wife, like one-on-one for the last time, I really feel like that's the time where he's able to really break through like who he was and what he did and actually have this redemption on the other side.
Right. Right. And it's, and you know, it's, I mean, you know, it's the misogyny of the day, right? You know, in order to prevent this greater injustice, he has to do something that he knows will result in the ruination of this person's character, right? Within the context of the society, right? Within the context of the society that polices her and her sexuality, right? And it's, again, you know, he has that lingering sort of, if not affection, then this feeling like he owes her something, you know. Now, whether he thinks he owes her something because he's wronged her or just because he knows what it'll do to her, you know, you can debate.
Absolutely.
But we come to act four now, act four that fall. So several months have passed.
Act whore.
Aha.
Think about it. You were tearing down heaven and raising up act four, and then as they say,
tearing down heaven. Yeah, that's what we call when we strike the set.
Mm-hmm. Oh, also, I completely lost this way earlier, act two, but there is a part that made me laugh, and I just have to note it. It's a line the stage direction says, "Elizabeth, with great fear, I fear nothing." Like, there are some bits in this, like, you know, that there is still like fun being had. Like, despite this being a very grim, horrifying story, made all the more horrifying by the conditions in which it was being written and the conditions of the actual historical tale. Like, there are moments of that kind of, like, the levity is not in the text, but it is in like some of the presentation. Like, there are moments in the editorializing where there are allowed like either little jokes or little bits of irony or whatever. It really is the only time that like light seeps into this thing, outside of just the light of a promise of some kind of future redemption, you know. Maybe some moments of ridiculousness of the courtroom itself. Like, there are moments that I remember seeing shows of this, and I've seen this played by multiple different theaters, and some places actually try to play a couple scenes in the courtroom for almost like just a touch of comedy. Like, Danforth gets so freaked out because she says, "I see it above you, Danforth," and he like ducks down, and it's like funny to see this guy in this big wig and this. But it's also like interesting because Miller talks in an article he wrote about how he showed students in a class one time a Hitler speech, like a full Hitler speech, to talk about fascism. And his students giggled multiple times because they're like, this guy looks like he's overacting. He literally had a student in his theater class to say, this guy looks like he's trying to play Hitler. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting thing, like the nature of this insane reaction. Hell, look at a Joseph McCarthy speech. I mean, like, to bring it back to the era, it is interesting. So, you know, there was also some humor there, but I just wanted to make that note. For whatever it's worth.
Oh yeah, you know, it's that affectation, you know, specifically with Hitler, like, it's that affectation of, you know, being, you know, apoplectic, right? To be barely able to contain this emotion, this hatred, this, you know, this purpose with which you are claiming that history drives you, you know. The Nazis were particularly big on the theatricality of it. I mean, if you look up the Cathedral of Lights, you know, the like big like square of spotlights that they would hold their rallies with, it's supposed to be, you know, terrifying and intimidating and take you out of the realm of the you know, the realm of the reasonable and the sensible.
So the last act is basically the ruling class of this town, Paris and Danforth and Hawthorne getting together. And they're like, so we may be on the verge of complete social collapse. There are cows just walking the streets without anyone to tend them. Crops rotting in the fields, children without parents. People
there's a rebellion
are
against the court over in the next township.
Yeah, I was going to know. And I thought that was interesting, right? It also shows that this is not irresistible, right? This is not a act of a unimpeachable elite. This is an elite that actually actively can be resisted, actively can be organized against, actively can be overthrown. In fact, the very fact that they have to beg these people for confessions is because they realize with every act of extreme brutality, they delegitimize themselves. They can do some brutality to scare people, but it actually has diminishing returns, which is just true about authoritarian regimes. And that's what Joseph McCarthy ended up ruining himself in the same way. He kept going after bigger and bigger targets. He got I mean, too big for his britches, as some people would
The
describe.
military, yeah.
Yeah, he decided to go after the military. And I mean, obviously, that's a little different than going after somebody like Rebecca Nurse. But in the same sense of like, this is a target that you cannot hit. But that is the natural, that's the nature of reaction. Reaction cannot stop, or it wouldn't be reactionary. It's going to keep on going and consuming and burning until the fire burns out, or it runs up against a wall it can't reach. And in this
Yeah.
case, it's the wall of resistance.
Yeah, and indeed, you know, it's you get to the point where the people perpetuating this do genuinely believe that that, I mean, again, as I said with Hale, you know, they tie up their legitimacy in something fundamentally illegitimate, right? Danforth, you know, you misunderstand, sir. I cannot pardon these when 12 are already hanged for the same crime. It is not just, you know,
yeah,
because, you know, justice has been construed to this particular to the particular end.
Meanwhile, like Paris is like, I hate these people more than any of the other ones, but it could be bad. Like, there are people talking about assassinating me. Like, he's dealing with that at this point. Also, Abigail has disappeared. Her and some of the girls have just like run off. They're like, okay, yeah, we've lost the plot here. They take off, and you know, we don't really know where they go. We don't know what becomes of them. And then they no longer, it's interesting. You know, Abigail serves as this antagonist up till now, but because the struggle is so much within Proctor, without the antagonist, it's actually able to be resolved. It's not like, oh, Abigail is defeated or Abigail wins. This thing has spiraled out of control of anybody, but beyond anybody's imagination. Abigail doesn't get to have John Proctor. Abigail doesn't actually get to kill the one person she intended to kill, nor does she end up having a good time.
There is a scene in the text that the author himself later dropped from it or disavowed or is it in your edition?
You're talking about Act Two, Scene Two?
Act Two, Scene Two. Yes.
It's at the end of my edition as like an after note.
Yeah, same. We agree on the editions we read beforehand, dear listeners.
totally.
But yeah, it's where Abigail meets John in the woods before all the trials start kicking off, and she is like, "Yeah, you know, I'm totally going to be with you once this is all over." What do you? There's probably a specific answer to this. What do you make of Arthur Miller dropping this? Because I think the ambiguity that we get from losing that scene is more powerful than just having Abigail say it straight up.
Frankly, I honestly think it has, this is maybe a more boring answer, but he dropped it after some showings of the show. I think he just realized it ruined the narrative flow. Act two going into act three is such a great transition from Proctor, like screaming at the sky, like let the cold wind blow. And then you have the court. That being the next time you see Proctor, my guess is he saw it on stage a few times and he was like, that's fat. But I also don't know. I might be wrong. But that was kind of my reading of it. And when I read the scene, I was like, yeah, that's fine. I also just think like for flow's purpose, it looks better. It looks better if you jump straight into Hawthorne saying, how do you know you're not a witch? You know, like it's a better step. But you know,
yeah, it's I mean, I do like the, I mean, we've come to this these conclusions that we've come to about Abigail without the benefit of the text, but I mean, I do genuinely, and I mean, it's a testament to Miller's strength as a writer. Of course, she has this monologue here that I love that basically spells out everything we've said about her.
Yeah, go for it.
You know, why you taught me goodness, she says, therefore you are good. It were a fire you walked me through, and all my ignorance was burned away. It were a fire, John, we lay in fire, and from that night no woman dare call me wicked anymore. But I knew my answer. I used to weep for my sins when the wind lifted up my skirts and blushed for shame because some old Rebecca called me loose. And then you burned my ignorance away. You know, she's, again, you know, not a relationship that that we approve of, but you know, nevertheless, one that sort of makes the scales fall from her eyes. You know, one from which Buffy, like, right, she wakes up from her first time and is like, wait a minute, I'm the same person that I always was. I've just indulged in this thing that people have said is bad and scary, and that I actually had fun with.
Yeah, and unfortunately, due to the, you know, structure of the society that leads to the violence that arises. I also like, notably here, you know, going into Act Four, I want to bring it back around to Hale a little bit, Reverend Hale, because he has quit the court. He actually goes for like a couple months just away, because there's some months between Acts 3 and 4. He's like, fuck this noise. I'm going like Jesus into the wilderness to figure this out. And he comes back and he just says, everybody just confess. This whole thing is bullshit. It's fine. Lie, ruin your good name, sell out your neighbor, whatever. Once again, spot the liberal. Right? Because Hale is saying, and I'm not saying that there's no, and I'm not saying like some kind of sense of like, if you're asked, hey, say you did something and like whatever, you'll get away. It's not about the moralism of whether like lying to get away with something is right, but it's notable that Hale, that John Proctor will need to not only sell out himself, he also needs to sell out his neighbors. He needs to sell out the people who are going to the noose. He needs to sell out other people in the town to get his freedom, as people were doing during the Red Scare, going before the House of Un-American Activities Committee and saying, he's a communist, I repent my sins.
And again, this is Arthur Miller, you know, like he's not going to do that. He's not going to speak for other people. He can only speak for his own sins.
And he literally didn't. Like it's actually very rare that you get to see. It's very funny that this book was written actually before Arthur did what John Proctor did, basically, here. It's remarkable, actually. And I wonder if Miller was on the stand like, well, I can't sell people out now. I wrote the book, man. he's like, damn it. I got to go to jail, I guess. Like, it's like a, I mean, I don't know what's going through his head, but it is funny to imagine. But hey,
I do.
What? You do?
Yeah. He and I talked about it the other day.
Okay, solid. Well, you seem to be conjuring witches, which we're going to have a conversation with the local court about this afterwards.
But. Yeah, we'll get to that. They got a backlog.
I saw Goody Olson but no, Hale has this part where he's talking to Elizabeth and he's like, just get your wife, get your husband to talk. Like, and he said, and this is, you know, Kim saying, let you not mistake your duty as I mistook my own. I came into this village like a bridegroom to his beloved, bearing gifts of high religion. The very crowns of holy law I brought, and what I touched with my bright confidence, it died. And where I turned the eye of my great faith, blood flowed up. Beware, Goody Proctor, cleave to no faith when faith brings blood. It is mistaken law that leads you to sacrifice. Life, woman, life is God's most precious gift. No principle, however glorious, may justify the taking of it. And he goes on and he's saying, and it's interesting because at this moment, this is, you know, Hale's redemption, in the sense of he is repenting of his sins. Nevertheless, his conclusion of what ought to be done here is despite how good it sounds when he's saying life is God's greatest gift, is actually not the conclusion of the book, which is interesting, or it's not the conclusion of the play. So it actually allows this character to have this very good, very fleshed out argument, this really, you know, pathos for why somebody would sell out their neighbor. Life is God's greatest gift. Why should you throw it away? Why should you have arrogance about that? Maybe God damns those who throw their life away casually more than liars. But at the end of the day, that's actually not the path that that John Proctor can walk. John Proctor cannot give his name away. Why, Joss?
Because it is all he has.
Oh, I was really hoping you would do the Daniel Day-Lewis. Because it is all no name. But, you know, that's
fine, too. I gotta watch that again. It's been like 10 years since I saw it.
It's all good. We should have, like, gotten together and watched ahead of the time. But, you know, instead the other day when we hung out, we watched... No Context Moments in American Politics, so I think that was even more important.
It's No Context Moments, and of course the Dracula Flow. Yes, the truly a poet laureate, the writer of that.
Dracula was here for this. He did speak about it. Dracula was actually the one they summoned, but nevertheless, so yeah, we see Proctor will not confess, and he has this moment where he's like, yeah, I'm gonna fucking die, and it sucks because Elizabeth's pregnant, and you know, I he really at this moment does not want to die. He feels that he has transcended his guilt, and you even have this moment of Elizabeth trying to be like, well, it was a cold home I kept. And Proctor's like, no, don't say that foolishness. I was an idiot. I was bad. I apologize to you, Elizabeth. And then she's like, you can make whatever choice you want. And Proctor in this moment gains his freedom and saying, all right, well, I'm not going to live like this. I'm going to go to my death. Notably, like, it is in Proctor, and then, you know, with him, Rebecca Nurse, the perfect woman's death in her saying the saintly prayer on at the noose and him walking away. And in fact, a lot of it's very common to end the show with the reading of the Lord's Prayer on the noose. Yeah, exactly. And it's a great way of doing it. Because it's like, because it is like, okay, well, ultimately they do go to God. They still have this belief in God. It is not a rejection of like the religious values, but really this literal witch hunt that has taken place. And in that, this society is able to, like, because it has taken that step too far, it has fully delegitimized itself in the eyes of the people. It has just driven itself to ruin with its own contradictions.
Salem, indeed. The name escapes me right now, but one commentator on this describes Salem as the rock on which the theocracy broke, right? Because what's going on right now? The Massachusetts Bay Colony is between colonial charters, and the new one has just come down that extends suffrage to people who are not church members, right? So at this point, when you, if you're not a church member and you see, you know, good God-fearing Puritans, you know, denouncing each other with spectral hearsay, you know, you don't want these people to have political power.
And it's notable, Proctor gets to have his, you know, final moment of declaration of victory, where he's saying, give them no tears, show a stony heart and sink them with it. And he lifts up his wife and he kisses her, it says, with great passion. They have this moment of rekindled romance and love. And he says, and I love this, you have made your magic now, for now I do think I see some shred of goodness in John Proctor. Not enough to weave a banner with, but white enough to keep it from such dogs. And I love that. Like, he's like, well, I, you know, and Elizabeth's last line is saying he has his goodness now. God forbid I take it from him. And as like they're walking off stage, Rebecca Nurse, I actually like, because Rebecca Nurse has never fallen down to these people's length. Her last line in the show, and I think this is notable, she said, she's like kind of like joking and saying, I've had no breakfast, like getting taken, like she knows she's nerd. Going to her eternal reward. Like, and I also think, I also like kind of appreciate that as well. Like, I guess Rebecca's case, Rebecca would just be like the perfect partisan who gets executed, or something like that. Like, she, you know, staunch, steadfast from the beginning. But and so it concludes, and there is a, I don't know if your edition has the echoes down the corridor. Does it have that in it? Afterword. It has the afterword where it says,
Yep. It does.
Yeah. Paris was voted from office. Legend has it Abigail turned up as a prostitute in Boston. 20 years after the last execution, the government awarded compensation.
You will.
So true. Yeah. It talks about that. Elizabeth Proctor married again. And this part is actually all, And this is all just correct. This is all historical fact here, what happened. And the truth is, we don't know what happened to Abigail Williams. We don't know what happened to all of these people, but we know some of them, you know, got to live comfortable lives. We also know some of the accusers got payouts because they accused their own family members.
Yes.
So it goes, because that's history. But there are lessons to be drawn, no doubt. And there were lessons in that day, and there were lessons, no doubt, in this day. I mean, I know we have certainly, we've not reached the levels of Red Scare that were reached in the 50s, but we by all means could. There is certainly this sentiment in the United States right now growing against those who would speak for justice, who would speak against imperialism. It's always existed, but it is heating up. There's been, you know, slanderous attacks against the independent press, slanderous attacks, especially on places like college campuses, getting people fired from jobs, coming for people, getting actors removed from their, people like Susan Sarandon or whatever, getting fired from jobs for supporting Palestine. Literally, you know, literally seeing students getting removed from, you know, schools. It's quite concerning. I saw just today that NYU basically revoked this girl's scholarship because she tore down an Israeli propaganda poster on her campus.
Exactly. Yes.
And as smeared her name. This is a thing that can reemerge, because that's the nature of reaction. But it is also worth noting that the reaction of Salem, the rabid insanity, them was so delegitimizing that Paris was removed from power. That it broke the society itself. And Salem at its time was just a little town. It was a town that could then just, okay, well, the culture around it could zip on in. But if we saw a Salem on a national, international scale, it would necessarily have to be replaced with an entirely new system, an entirely new world. And it's only through organization, education, and understanding of the possibility of building a world beyond that, that we can have no more Salems. But I do fear that we will see a great witch hunt in the coming years.
Yes.
And we got to decide which side we're on.
Well, yes, you know, and I mean, you know, notably the, was it on Breakthrough News or was it on the Socialist Program, right? Where somebody, you know what I'm talking about. Somebody called in and was like, hey, you know, I'm worried about being an open socialist at my job, right? What was Brian Becker's response? His response was, look.
He said, when the government starts firing people openly for being socialist, we will be close to having won, with something yes. along those lines.
Yes, exactly. And that's the thing, you know, there will be horror. There will be insanity. People will feel like they're being gaslit, because they are, you know, they're being told by the president that, I saw the firsthand evidence of 40 babies beheaded. You know, they're being told outright lies about, you know, a people struggling for national liberation, and that people will win their national liberation there, and people will win national liberation here in all their various nations. There will be plenty of horror, and there will be plenty of violence, and there will be plenty of trauma to get to that point, but that point will be gotten to.
I saw Goody Proctor with Hamas. They were in the woods. They were building rockets.
Goody Proctor actually like ran up to a Merkava tank and just like planted a bomb on it and ran away.
Mm-hmm. That's the alternate ending. He wasn't allowed to publish that. It's similar to how The Jungle, a lot of people took out the last few socialist chapters. It had a national liberation struggle. So stupid. The bits will get worse until morale improves. Well, that's, you know, my main thoughts. And I loved revisiting this. It's fun to bring back, you know, memories of a show that I have, like, you know, this personal experience with. I can now approach from a more mature political perspective and just mature perspective in general. I can have fun thinking about all that. And I can also have fun, you know, we can have fun talking about theater, which is a sort of a new addition, a new little thing in the mix. So,
and certainly not the last. Certainly not the last. I would love to talk about the first and only play that I ever directed. Was like, I tend to jump into things with both feet without really considering the full ramifications of what I'm taking on. So the first and only play that I ever directed was fucking The Spanish Tragedy by Thomas Kidd.
I did not know that. What the hell?
In my senior year of college, it was a trip. And I would love to talk about that play at some point in the future, because there's a lot to unpack there in terms of institutional failure.
Yeah, no, there's any number of plays we could do. You know, I always thought the first play we do on this podcast would be Macbeth, because I'm fucking obsessed with Macbeth, but, you know, we'll get around to it, though. Drawing the socialist analogies will be a little more difficult. I'm sure we can wring some blood from that turnip. No doubt.
Yeah. Merchant of Venice. That would be another good one, actually.
Honestly, Death of a Salesman would not be bad.
I'll add it to the list. There is a list. Folks.
There is a list. We're really good at following it. in our own way. So as of today, we are not going to announce next week, because we are juggling potential guest situation, but as soon as I have something locked in, I will announce it on our social media at Socialist Shelf or Socialist Shelf Podcast on Twitter and Instagram, and I guess Blue Sky as well, even though I don't really know that anyone's doing that anymore. I've thrown around the idea in my head of putting together a website, but I don't know that people actually visit websites. So, you know, maybe that'll be a thing. And if it's not a thing, you know, you're hallucinating this. The devil made you hear it.
Yes, please report to your nearest, ecclesiastical authority.
Yes, God, please. Joss, before we go, I just, was going to ask, just like straight up, do you consider yourself, you know, do you consider yourself cringe?
I consider myself quite based, but you know, that's just
but
one
if
man's
you
opinion.
Don't know what a cringe is, then how would you know you're not cringe?
Yes. Shit, I hadn't thought of that.
There are several times throughout the play where they say base, which I know that means like lower, but I'm just like, God, my brain is fried. Like they were like, this base debauchery.
You think me base? I never accused you of being base.
Honestly, thank God that like that had not really entered popular vernacular when I was in high school and doing this show, because we would have not been able to hold it together as a bunch of like 15, 16 year olds reading these lines. I mean, you know, we barely managed to get through yelling Jezebel at our classmates. So like, you know, but also I guess I'll close it out on one more story from my days as Governor Danforth, and hopefully this will be a useful analogy of some kind. We were doing our last show of the Crucible, and we were not going to get to do another one, but they decided to do one more show. Our teacher, in fact, like helped pay to get this venue for us because we had been so successful, and we wanted to do the full thing without the shortened bits because we had done the competition version. We wanted to do all of it. We needed a bigger space. And it was a big space. It was beautiful, and it was a great show. And just as Governor Danforth rises to give that monologue that I read for you earlier, a hook from the top of the stage hooked my wig.
No.
And pulled it off of my head as I came down. And you know what I did? I yanked it down and I kind of tried to stay in character and acted all like, oh, this is all part of the whatever, and people laughed and I was like silence and whatever, trying to do all that. And remembering that, I think, and now thinking about this podcast today, you know, not a lot has changed. I'm doing the same thing now. And so if there's the proverbial wig slip at any point, I'm just going to shove it back on my head and act like that was the plan the whole time. Yeah. Just get it back on your head. Well, avoid witches and
shove wigs.
And shove wigs. Have a good one.
Peace out, y'all.
Listening to Socialist Shelf Radio.